a call for real news out of Gaza.
I do want us to have a clear understanding of what went on and one that has some basis in reality.
Plus, a look at how one car company is going beyond fuel economy to look for alternative ways to reduce our carbon footprint. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. The tensions in Gaza heated up in November with attacks from both sides ending with nearly 150 dead in Palestine and 6 dead in Israel. At the same time, Palestine's effort to win further UN recognition was being discouraged by both Israel and the U.S., with those countries arguing only negotiations could create an independent Palestinian state. Cindy and Craig Corey watched the developments in Gaza closely. Their daughter, Rachel, was run over by an Israeli bulldozer in 2003 as she protested along the Rafah-Egyptian border with 9 others. An Israeli court ruled this year that Rachel was to blame. She put herself in harm's way. Her parents have taken up the piecework their daughter died for. And the Rachel Corey Foundation this year won the Lennon Ono Grant for Peace. For people who don't know, and I can't believe there are too many anymore that don't, but your daughter, Rachel Corey, died doing peace work in the Middle East. And you've picked up where she left off and continued her mission. But did you ever envision this for yourselves?
Absolutely not. I frequently tell people that if you had told me 10 years ago that I would be doing, that I would have done the things that I've done during this period since Rachel was killed, I would have said that you were crazy. And of course, if somebody had told me that my child would die in such a way, I would have told you that I wouldn't have taken another breath after that.
Yeah, I guess I'd also say that I don't really think that I do sort of Rachel's work or continue Rachel's work. I think Rachel brought us to this issue. She brought us to her friends. But I think, you know, after 10 years or almost 10 years, it has to be your own work. It has to be your own dedication and not about somebody else, or you can't continue to do it.
So when fighting breaks out between Israel and Palestine, you have a really clear view of what you think is going on and what the process might have been that isn't working. What is your reaction when you see what's been going on there?
It's particularly concerning when it happens within Gaza because we know how vulnerable that population is. It's 1.7 million people, including families that we know, children that we know, and they really have had virtually nowhere to escape to. On a recent trip, Craig and I visited a kibbutz in southern Israel. We visited communities in that area, so we understand that it's a terrible thing to be facing rocket fire that comes from Gaza. But the situation, the context is different. But I do know that the Israeli government does provide for shelters for people. There are warnings, and that's something that people in Gaza don't have at all. So I think, and because of the difference, even though we oppose the violence on all sides, and I'm very clear that when rockets are fired towards civilian populations, those are human rights violations. Any time a civilian population is targeted, those are human rights violations. But I think it's the power differential here is very, very great. And so I think we also feel a need to try to help people understand that and to understand the violence of the occupation, which has gone on for so many years, and that has really created this difficult situation.
Cindy and I were actually in Gaza. We went into Gaza on November 5th and came out on the 11th. On the 5th, there was apparently mentally challenged person who wandered close to the border with Israel and was shot and killed on the 5th. That's something that you don't really hear about in the Western news. There was a child. On Friday we went to a funeral tent for a child, a 13-year-old boy who was shot and killed the day before. And I talked with his father there. Then Cindy went on to the house and talked with his mother, who she said was in a fetal position on the floor crying. The little boys, that 13-year-old friends of the boy that was killed, they talked to us as well, and they said he was a goaltender. He was a goalie for their soccer game that the way we were playing out in front of his house. This child was, I would guess, about a kilometer and a half from the border. There were bulldozers and tanks that were destroying olive trees about halfway between him and the border, roughly speaking. And somehow a bullet came out up there, probably, I would guess, shot from a helicopter, and killed this kid like any other kid playing soccer. You know, Israeli news reported that, and I think coming from the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, said they had shot somebody that was acting suspiciously. Well, it was a child playing goalie. That's not suspicious in any place in this world. And I think that sort of history is part that we know because we were there. And I think Friday night we heard from Palestinians that a funeral group had just been bombed by the Israelis, and then the rocket firing started up back across the border, and you see that escalation. And you also hear the pronouncements, particularly by our government, but others. Our government is quick to say that Israel has the right to protect itself, and of course it does. So do the Palestinians. Just reiterating that sort of fact of international law doesn't do anybody good. I'm more interested in who has the courage to reach out with peace on each side, who has the courage to try to settle that, settle down the violent situation and try to lead to a future in that area where all the individuals, all those children, all the soccer players on both sides of that green line can find a future, and that future will be together. I hope, due to the sort of changing word that we heard, news that we got out of the area, both by our mainstream media and also from our government, that maybe people are learning. Maybe the understanding of what was going on there changed throughout those days. And it seems to me like if the State Department just said with very neutral language, here's what happened today, you know, a rocket was fired and it either hit nothing or hurt somebody, killed somebody, and a bomb was dropped. But make sure that the language is absolutely neutral, that you don't condone any sort of violence and that you don't excuse any of that, no matter which side it is on. I think that our understanding of what was going on there would become more clear. I think you could go back and look at a history, if we kept it up day by day, when we could see these things escalate, and we could point to what happened, the whole world could point to what happened in a more straightforward fashion. So I don't want to just point fingers at Israel, but I do want us to have a clear understanding of what went on, and one that has some basis in reality.
I would assume you're pretty familiar with people interested in peace on both sides. Is there a strong will among government leaders, any of them, to create a peaceful solution here?
Settlement expansion just continues at a very, very high rate. Really, everywhere you go, in East Jerusalem, in the areas around Jerusalem, in the West Bank, you see efforts just to change the facts on the ground so that it becomes less likely for the Palestinians, for example, to have a viable state. Many Israeli friends feel that's an impossibility. There are those that are still advocating for a two-state solution here, and we don't really take a position on that. But I think for people to talk about peace, for governments to talk about peace, but then to allow the processes to continue that are in violation of international law and make that peace more difficult to reach, really raises questions about the motivations.
It's been over 2 years since we talked to a high-level official in the White House, and he said, and this was right after the attack on the Mavi Marmara, and he said at that time, he said, one thing is clear, that the policy of isolating Gaza and a siege on Gaza is a failed policy. And yet we've continued that policy now for 2 more years. And I just call on all of our leaders to, again, act with courage in protecting everyone's rights in those areas and in trying to act with true neutrality to bring this forward. And I think also calling on both Israel and the Palestinian factions that are there, both Hamas and the PLO, to act on their best statements, on their most optimistic sort of statements and ideals. And I think that if we hold up to ourselves and each other the best that we can act on, I think that it'll go better than trying to label people as either corrupt or warmongers or terrorists, you know, whatever the side is. I think we can do better than that, and I think our government could lead the way. And I hope we started to see them move in the right direction.
Cindy and Craig Corey are the founders of the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice. Find out more at rachelcoreyfoundation.org. Coming up, biodegradable, sustainable cars. They're getting closer to reality. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1222. Sustainable cars aren't new ideas. Back in the early 40s, Henry Ford developed the world's first bio car. It was a prototype displayed at a motor show in Michigan. The car's plastic panels were made from soybeans, wheat, and hemp. Ford's prototype didn't survive the Second World War, but the idea of biodegradable plastic parts lives on.
Henry Ford had the right idea. Back in the early 1940s, he developed the world's first bio car. Actually, it was a prototype displayed once at a motor show in Dearborn, Michigan. The car's plastic panels were made from soybeans, wheat, and hemp. Sadly, Ford's prototype didn't survive the Second World War, but the idea of biodegradable plastic parts lives on. In fact, a handful of car companies, Toyota, Mazda, and Honda, hope to create a bioplastics industry. Bioplastics are made from plants like corn instead of crude oil, and they degrade naturally over time. But making Henry Ford's vision real hasn't been easy. When exposed to sun, rain, and air, bioplastic begins to, rot, perhaps a bit quicker than you might want. However, Toyota sees it as a challenge that leads to opportunity, and perhaps they're right. Mazda recently developed a special additive that overcomes some of the problems. The instrument panel they showed off is made mostly from corn with just a touch of petroleum. Henry Ford's biological car was ahead of its time, but hopefully we'll be lucky enough to see it in ours. To learn more, go to islaearth.org. Isla Earth is produced by the Catalina Island Conservancy with support from its Fund for a Sustainable Planet, because Earth is an island.
Isla Earth is produced by the Catalina Island Conservancy with support from its Fund for a Sustainable Planet. The Ford Motor Company is still working to design sustainable cars, and much of their biomaterials team are women. Dr. Ellen Lee explained reducing petroleum products goes much farther than just improved gas mileage.
I think when people think of a car company trying to be greener, they simply think of fuel, and you're in an entirely different area, which also has an impact.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, the fuel economy definitely has a big part to play in being sustainable.
But what we're trying to do is to look at the materials we choose to use and the processes that we use to make those materials to go into our cars so that we can reduce our carbon footprint from those from the inside out, from looking at what actually goes onto the vehicle.
So give me an example.
So one of our first innovations to make it to our vehicles is soy foam technology. And what that is we've taken some of the petroleum that's used to make the foam cushions that are in the seats of your vehicle and replaced that with soybean oil. So that launched on one vehicle about 5 or 6 years ago now, and now it's on every vehicle that we produce in North America. So with that technology, we're able to reduce our CO2 emissions by over 30 million pounds every year.
And I'm going to guess that there is a high initial cost just to find out how to do it. But once you know, is it equivalent? Is it less or more expensive?
Well, it really depends on a lot of things. A lot of the things we're doing is trying to replace petroleum-based products, plastics and composites and foams and things like that in your vehicle. And so a lot of the cost equation depends on how much oil costs. Now that the infrastructure has developed, farmers are, you know, in the loop, and there are a lot of suppliers that are supplying these chemicals. A lot of that, the economies of scale are kicking in, and it's much lower in price. And so we're still able to do it very economically. So there's a business case for that. And that's one of the main things that we look for in the business to be able to use these renewable products. We know that it is sustainable for the environment, but in order to be sustainable as a business, because we are a profitable business, we have to have that business case. It can't be way more expensive.
And I'm guessing there is a certain amount of either buy-in or non-buy-in from the corporation itself to encourage these kind of innovations.
Yes, sir. I think that we're lucky in that Ford has it in our brand DNA. From Henry Ford, our founder, he was really innovative and really sustainably minded himself. In fact, there's this great story where he would very carefully specify the crates that some of his parts be shipped in, because once they came to the assembly plant and he took the parts out and put them onto the vehicles, he would take the crates apart and use the wood as the floorboards to his vehicles.
Well, so right now you've been looking at this cushioning. Where else do you look at the cars for an opportunity to reduce the use of petroleum products?
We look wherever we can. Any place that has a petroleum-based plastic or composite material is something that we have considered. And a lot of people don't know that there is a pretty significant amount of plastics and composite materials in your vehicles. The average vehicle has approximately 300 pounds or so. So, you know, it's about 10%, I would say. And if when you're sitting in your vehicle, pretty much everything that you touch and interact with is a plastic or, you know, a petroleum-sourced material. So a lot of our first innovations are looking at some of the interior cabin.
I also assume you are looking for lighter weight as well as equally strong. If there's such a way to do that, is that will also reduce the use of petroleum products?
Yes, exactly. So one of the things that we're really looking at is, you know, in a lot of cases, the plastic and composites that we use in our vehicles are reinforced with fiberglass or minerals to make them stiffer or stronger to impart whatever properties they need for that function. And what we're trying to do is replace those components with natural fibers or fillers and trying to concentrate on things that are waste streams from other products. For example, one of the materials that is in our vehicles today is a wheat straw reinforced plastic, and that's the straw that is the byproduct after the wheat grain is harvested off. Usually that would be burned in the field for the most part. And we've taken that and mixed it in with plastic so we can not only reduce the amount of plastics we use, reduce some of these non-renewable things like mineral fillers and glass, but we can also get a lighter weight material. So that also translates to better drivability and handling as well as improved fuel economy if you can really start taking the weight out.
All right. And it's kind of fun to be talking to a woman who's involved in this research.
I would say it's still a growing field for women. It's hard for me to say directly because my immediate working team is very unusual. We are mostly women-driven group. We have 6 members, and only one is a man, which is usually the opposite of what you would find in the automotive industry.
And so if you're a girl listening, and this sounds like a really interesting field, what do you study?
What I studied was chemical engineering, but we also have on our team materials science and engineering majors, as well as mechanical engineers.
And how did it happen that it is a mostly women group? It just was an accident?
I think so. I don't think that there was any forces trying to recruit women necessarily to the group. It just happened that way. It really is unusual, but it works pretty well. We have a really great dynamics in our group.
Dr. Lee, if you were to make wild conjectures about what kind of cars you could envision in the next 20, 30 years, what do you think is possible?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, if you told me about some of the innovations that are on the vehicle today, you know, with 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't have believed it. So, I mean, the sky's the limit on what those vehicles could be like. But I know that there's been a lot of talk about developing technologies that allow the vehicles to talk to one another so that you could have a safer drive, you know, avoid collisions and that sort of thing. Some of the vehicles could be autonomous, being able to kind of maneuver themselves. But I think that in terms of the materials and the sustainability, the fuel economy, we're going to make huge strides because petroleum is a limited resource right now. I think that there are so many technologies to help conserve that, to improve the fuel economy, and then that goes hand in hand with the materials that we use too. In my opinion, the cost of petroleum is just going to keep going up. And so as these new renewable technologies develop, it'll be more and more economical. It'll make more sense. And the technologies will develop enough for us to make most of the plastics probably out of a renewable source.
Dr. Ellen Lee is part of the biomaterials team at the Ford Motor Company. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.